Hey. Good to have you here. Perhaps for some of you, you haven't been coming very long, or I don't know if you have a tie to this space. In Catholic and in Jewish traditions, many other religious traditions as well, there's a really robust view of sacred space, that there are some spaces that are unique and where the presence of the divine, depending on the religion or whatever, is unique to certain spaces in a special way. And for the most part, non-Catholic, non-Orthodox, non-Eastern Orthodox Christianity, i.e. Protestants, with the broad Christian tradition that we're part of, we kind of are just impoverished in this area. and so we like build basketball courts and then have church in them or something. And then that's kind of fine in the sense of like the whole earth belongs to the Lord and yes, he's everywhere and so on. But there really is strong precedence in the scriptures for the fact that when God shows up in certain spaces, it marks them in a unique and in a special way. And when that happens, God's people need to remember that and reflect on it and internalize it and somehow find a way to take that with them. And so that's what we're going to reflect on tonight. And as I thought about, like, how do you share? For many of us, this space is very special, and special things have happened here that we're going to reflect on. And so how do you find words adequate for it? And this is why the Bible's great, because this was the point at which I was thinking, and then this obscure, random story in the Bible that many of you probably didn't even know was in there in the first place came into my mind. And I was like, that's perfect, that's the one. And so it has everything and nothing to do with what we're doing here tonight, but that's what we're going to read. You guys with me? Great. So I invite you to open up your Bibles and turn with me to the book of 2 Kings. 2 Kings, and you will likely need your table of contents. No shame. No shame in that fact. Book of 2 Kings, chapter 5. And it's a story about this random guy who has an encounter, a surprising encounter, with God's grace in a very special space, and he is compelled to somehow memorialize what happened in that space. 2 Kings chapter 5. Now, Naaman, he was the commander of the army of the king of Aram, and he was a great man in the sight of his master and highly regarded, because through him, the Lord, and remember, when you see in your translations the Lord with all capital letters, that this is the translator's telling you that the Hebrew word under that is the God of Israel's covenant name, his personal covenant name, which is Yahweh. So I'll say that when we come across it. So because through him, Yahweh had given victory to Aram. Now, he was a valiant soldier, but he had, leprosy. Now, bands of raiders from Aram had gone out and taken captive a young girl from Israel, Let's just stop here for a moment. Who, what, when, where? Exactly. Yeah, exactly, right? So this is what happens most of the time you open the Old Testament, right? You just get lost. Like, what on earth is this? And so we're, it's page 336, right? Fairly, at least in my Bible. So I don't know what it is in yours. This is what makes the Old Testament challenging is it's long, and there's stories with plots within subplots and so on. And so at any given moment, just to, get your head above the clouds and where am I and so on. So let me be a geek and join those of you who are geeks also, and kind of we'll get the timeline and the maps, and then we'll dive back in to the story. But it's important to know when the story occurs, where it occurs in the story of the Bible helps you understand a number of things that are very powerful that are going on in the story. So let me show you a timeline here to locate us in the biblical storyline. I always feel so bad when I forget to tell the good people. There you go. Thank you very much. Okay, perfect. So here's this great timeline. I don't know if it's great. It's a timeline. How great are timelines? I don't know. Some of you think they're great. I think they're great. So let's say we have Abraham, the first Israelite called by God to become the nation of Israel. So 1500 is where we're working here. And then we have the main events, you know, of Exodus from Egypt, Mount Sinai. We've already gone through the wilderness. We've gone into the Promised Land. And this story is taking place in the kingdom period of Israel. It was about almost a 500-year period. It started with a guy named Saul, and then Israel's most famous king after him, David. And so that kind of began the kingdom period that went on for about 400 years until the exile to Babylon. So our story that we're reading here today falls kind of right smack in the middle, mid-800s. And that's important for a number of reasons. One is the kingdom period. Is this a happy period in Israel's story or not so happy? Yeah, it's not that great. It's not that great. And so you have, first of all, it kind of started with near civil war, and the country splits in two. And then there's 20 generations of kings on one side, another 20 on another. Out of those 40 kings, there were eight ones that stayed devout, full allegiance to Yahweh. So that's not that great average, really. And so this is during a time when most, your average Israelite, would maybe remember Yahweh, like that stuff that happened in the past. But from all the stories that were told, most of the Israelites thought Yahweh was just kind of one god among all the Canaanite gods. And I've got this Canaanite neighbor, and they worship Baal, and he makes the rain happen, and so I'm going to worship him too, you know. And that's just kind of how it went. Most of the kings of Israel were not devout to Yahweh. They didn't remember the stories of what happened in Exodus from Egypt and so on. And so that's where people are at. During this period, Yahweh raises up a group of women and men who tend to be odd, odd, eccentric figures who call the people of Israel back to the covenant with Yahweh. What are these people called? They're called the prophets, the prophets. And so this is the scene here. We have a king gone astray, nation gone astray, that's having difficult times surviving in the politics of the ancient Near East, and you have these prophets who are calling Israel back to himself. Now, a funny thing about this story, too, is that most of the stories in the Bible are about the people of Israel or people from Israel. But who does this story about? Yes, it's not about an Israelite at all. It's this guy named Naaman, who's the captain of all the military of what kingdom? So, see, of Aram or Aram, or some of your translations don't have that. They have Syria, yeah. Okay, so here's what's going on with that, and this is the map. So this kingdom was a nation of people. They lived up to the northeast. And so their kingdom, the capital of the ancient Arameans or the ancient Syrians, is the same capital of modern Syria today. The boundaries are actually roughly the same of ancient Syria and modern Syria. And so Damascus was their capital. It's where the stage of the civil war that's happening right now. And so they were longtime neighbors to the northeast. And Israel and Aram, or the Syrians, they were at war on and off for about 150 years. If you flip back just a few pages, it tells about a war between Aram, the Syrians, and Israel. And so Naaman, he's already led military campaigns against Israel. They clash. They would fight at certain times of year. Usually not the winter, because your chariots get stuck in the mud and this kind of thing. So they'd bring out the chariots in the summer, and they would fight. And so down here is the kingdom of Israel with the two main cities, Samaria and Jerusalem. They've been at war already. There appears to be a lull, a time of peace right now, as we're going to see in this story. But so this is fraught with political tensions. There's violence in the recent past. They're going to be at war again in just a couple more chapters. But it's this random story about this captain of the Syrians' army. What is going on here? Why are we reading a story about him? Now, so is he a good guy or a bad guy then? If you're an Israelite, he's a bad guy. He's killed people that you know. He's a commander of an army that's probably raided a friend of a town, you know, that some friends or family or lived in. He's a bad guy to you if you're an Israelite. But we're told that Yahweh had given victories to Aram through this guy. So, yes, Yahweh is the God who redeemed Israel from slavery, but is God only the God of the tribe of Israel? Is he at work in people's stories outside of his own covenant people? Yes. Yeah. And Israel you know, doesn't reflect on that very often in the scriptures, except to say that it's true. But those stories aren't really told in the Hebrew Bible, except like this one. Let's keep on reading. He's a valiant soldier. What's his problem? He has leprosy. Now, leprosy in the Bible refers to a pretty wide range of skin diseases, not quite as precise as our English words. So we don't know what exactly he had. We know that in honor-shame culture like this, patriarchal honor-shame culture, this would have been not just like a health problem that he had. This would affect his social status, the way he was perceived by people. This could spell, you know, career doom for him. And so his place in society is at stake as well. And so, here we go. He has leprosy. Let's go back into the story now. And we have bands of raiders that sometime in the past, they had gone out and taken captive a young girl from Israel. And she served Naaman's wife. Now this little girl, this little Israelite girl, she said to her mistress, she said, "Oh, if only my master would go see the prophet who lives in Samaria, he would cure Naaman of his leprosy." So Naaman went to his master. Who's that? So who's Naaman? Yeah, he's the captain of all the military. So who's his master? He's the king of the Syrians, the king of Aram. So he's like second most influential guy in the kingdom here. So he went to his master, and he told him what this little girl from Israel had said. It must have made an impact on him, clearly. "By all means, go," the king of Aram replied. "In fact, I'm going to pull some strings for you, diplomatic strings here. I'm going to send a letter with you to the king of Israel." So Naaman left, and he took with him a whole bunch of cash, essentially, right? 10 talents of silver. Now, look at some of you might have a little footnote. What's 10 talents? About 750 pounds of silver, right? 6,000 shekels of gold. Look at your little footnote there. Was it tell you? What are we talking here? About 150 pounds. Holy, that's a lot of cash. That's what that is. It's a lot of cash. And he's not carrying this on his back. He's got a whole entourage, chariots and wagon trains and so on to carry all of this. And I like this, 10 sets of clothing. So does he need them for the road? Is this part? It seems like it's money, so it's part of the gift? It's just sharing the fashion of the Arameans? I don't know. What is this? But he's loaded, right? The letter that he took to the king of Israel, here's what it said inside. "With this letter, I am sending my servant Naaman to you so that you can cure him of his leprosy." Now, how healthy is this relationship right here between the two kings? Not healthy at all. They were just at war, and they're going to be, again, not very long. And so you're the king of Israel, and the military commander that you have seen before and to like raid your towns and stuff, he shows up with all this money and a letter saying, like, heal him. Is this a good day for you? You know? No, this is a really bad day. This is the definition of a bad day, which he clearly sees it as that. Look at verse 7. He says, "As soon as the king of Israel read the letter," he's going to need the 10 sets of clothes, "he tore his robes, and he said, 'What? Am I God? What is this? Can I kill and bring back to life and heal people? Why is this fellow sending someone to me to be cured of his leprosy? What? Look, surely he's trying to pick a fight with me. He's trying to pick a quarrel with me. How else do you read this strange, bizarre scenario that just shows up at your doorstep?" Verse 8. Now, the prophet steps in, and his name? Elisha. Crazy dude. Elisha, the man of God, heard that the king of Israel had torn his robes. And so he sent him this message. He said, Why have you torn your robes? Have the man come to me, and he will know that there is a prophet in Israel. So Naaman went with his horse and his chariots. Now we get a picture of the entourage here. And they stop at the door of Elijah's house. And I like this part. Elijah sent a messenger. So that's like read between the lines there. So this is one of the second most important men in the kingdom of the Syrians, and he shows up at your door, and Elijah doesn't even like stoop to answer his own door. He just sends him a messenger, right? And there's a messenger to say to him, and here's what he says. Go. Don't stay here. Go. Wash yourself 7 times in the Jordan River, and your flesh will be restored, and you will be cleansed. Now, Naaman wouldn't know any of this, but you, as an informed reader of the Old Testament, up to this point in the story, Elisha sending Naaman down to the is the Jordan a place of significance in the story so far? So this is actually, when you're reading stories in the Old Testament, places are hugely significant. Places are both geographical places on a map, but also they have symbolic value for every story that's happened at that place up till now. You're just supposed to know that and have it in your head as a reader, informed reader of the Old Testament. And so what kinds of things have happened at the Jordan River? Some very significant things. So when the Israelites were redeemed out of slavery in Egypt and Yahweh rescued them through miraculously parting the Red Sea. There's that whole story, and through on dry land, but then it crashes in on the Egyptians when they chase after them. They go through the wilderness, and then they enter into the land promised to Abraham. And how do they enter? They come to the Jordan River, and which is at this border valley. It's a really low border valley that today still divides the West Bank and Israel from modern-day Jordan. And it's not a big river. It's not like the Willamette at all. It's more like the Sandy River. And at certain parts, you know how like the Sandy, it's kind of flowing, but you can strap on your backpack and you've got your barbecue and kind of wade. You know, you can make it across at certain parts. But at other parts, you know, it's more like the size of 20th right here and kind of rushing, and you wouldn't try and cross it there. So that's like more like what the Jordan is. The nation of Israel, they come to the river. This is told in the book of Joshua. And so something very similar happens, but this new event to mark them, Yahweh reduces the flow of the Jordan to a trickle so that the children of the generation that came out of Egypt can cross over the Jordan and into the land promised to Abraham. And something happened in that moment. Do you guys remember this story? Maybe you know it if you've read Joshua. So how many tribes are in the nation of Israel? There's 12 tribes. And so Joshua tells the leader of each of the 12 tribes as they're walking through the Jordan River, so the riverbed, to pick up these huge stones. 12 leaders pick up 12 huge stones and carry them to the other side. And then when they pass, the river starts flowing again. And so they set up this huge 12 stone altar, this memorial, to remember who they are and who Yahweh is and what happened here. The Jordan becomes this place that reminds Israel of who they are and who God is to them. God's the one who redeemed them out of their oppression and slavery in Egypt. He's the one who, as a sheer gift, is giving them the inheritance promised to Abraham and so on. They are the passed through the waters to become the people of Yahweh kind of people. And so the Jordan is full of the symbolism and heritage and history. And so for Elisha, this to say something like this, go, you know, cleanse yourself and dip 7 times in the Jordan, that's loaded with meaning and significance. Is it for Naaman? No, he didn't grow up with that story. That's not his people and so on. And so he doesn't care about any of that. And that's clear in his response. Look what he says, verse 11. He says, Naaman went away angry. He's ticked. He said, no, this is not how it was supposed to go. I like this. I thought he was surely going to come out to me personally, not send a messenger, what? And stand and call on the name of Yahweh, his God, and wave his hand over me or something. You know? Wave his hand over the spot and cure me of my leprosy. So he had a little story in his head about how this was going to go. I'm going to go down and so here's this, I guess, this sorcerer, this Yahweh Israelite sorcerer or something, and he's going to come do his little magic show and make me better because this little girl said that might happen. So, like, really, that's about what he's going on here. And he's clearly, like, go wash in this river. What? It's weird. Why is he asking me to do this? And he's clearly got hometown pride. Look at what he says. He says, no, river. Aren't Abana and the Pharpar, the rivers of Damascus, they're way better than the waters of Israel. What do you mean? If I wanted to wash in a river, why'd I come all the way here with 10 sets of clothes? Like, no, wouldn't have done that. So here's what's happening here. So get this. Does he expect anything to happen? Clearly not. What he expected to happen was a little magic show for Elijah, and he's a little tribal diviner or something, sorcerer, and he's going to make me better in the name of his local god. Something. That's what's going on in his head. He doesn't care who Yahweh is. He doesn't care about the Jordan and the whole story. He doesn't care. He's not looking for Yahweh. He's not expecting anything to happen. If anything, he's clearly now kind of snobby and anti whatever's, I don't care. It was ridiculous. And so he says, couldn't I wash in those rivers and be cleansed? He turned and went off in a rage. He's over it. Who cares? Yahweh, this was a cruel joke. But Naaman's servants, look at verse 13. Naaman's servants went to him and they speak a little sense to him. They address him really politely. My father, listen, if the prophet had told you to do some great thing, wouldn't you have done that? So if he told you to, I don't know, drink a potion or something, right, with Eye of Newt. When I think of potions, I think of a potion with Eye of Newt. You know what I'm talking about? Like the jars? Anyway, so drink a potion, whatever. If he told you to do something, you know, do jumping jacks or say abracadabra or something, wouldn't you have done it? That would be like magic to you. So if you would have done something kind of crazy and great like that, how much more if he just told you to do something very simple, like just go wash and be cleansed in that river? So he went down and went to the river. Now, this is what's great about Old Testament style storytelling, is what went on in his head. Apparently, he was compelled. Okay, good point. All right, here I go. I'm going to go now. But he was really ticked. So what happened inside of him? Something happened. We don't know. We're not told. You just have to infer. There was something compelling here, under the surface. But he goes. He goes down, and he dipped himself in the Jordan River 7 times, just as the man of God had told him. And these, because storytelling is so sparse, often in the style is so sparse in the Old Testament, this is where my mind starts going crazy. Like, what happened? What was that like? Like, were his servants with him? Did he strip naked? Was he counting? Did he count aloud? Did he count in his head? You know? Like, and so by 4, nothing's happened. Is that weird to him? Is he starting, you know, like, really think through what this would have meant for this guy. He's the captain of an army. Strip and go in this river. This is weird. This is so weird, right? But he dips himself 7 times. The 7th time he comes up, whoosh, his flesh was totally restored and he became clean. It was like that of a young boy. So we don't know how old he was. We don't know if he had crow's feet, you know, those, and we don't know. But his skin is completely healed and restored. So stop right here. Let's just reflect on one fact. This is a powerful truth of the story. Was this guy looking for Yahweh? Did he even care about Yahweh or think that Yahweh was real or anything was going to happen? No. No. So he thought this was a sham and ridiculous and about to go home. But he ends up being compelled by some friends, like, just do it. And in Yahweh's mercy, he just totally meets this guy right where he's at. Wasn't looking for Yahweh. It's totally, you know, if anything, he's anti. And God totally meets him and heals him. God's grace happens to him. He was on nobody's list to get healed, you know what I mean, or to have a powerful encounter with Yahweh, but it happens. Let's keep reading. Then Naaman and all his attendants, they went right back, as you can imagine, to the man of God. And he stood before him and he said, now I know that there is no God in all the world except Israel. Now again, just reflect on what that means. This is a world where nations have tribal national deities. As we're going to find out, he had given his allegiance to the god of Aram named Ramon, and this is huge for him. This is not just like, oh, oh, those gods aren't a big deal. I'm going to follow this one now. This is significant. This is like changing your allegiance, your national allegiance. Your identity has been bound up with Ramon, and he protects Aram, and he gives us victory in our battles and so on. And now he discovers that this Yahweh, who we know from the beginning, has had his hand in Naaman's story for a long time, long before Naaman was ever aware of it, because he's been giving Aram victory through Yahweh has been doing this. And he has this wake-up moment of like, holy cow, like what? This is real. I thought this was a sham and a little local sorcerer or something. This is the one true God. Whatever Rimmon is or Baal, these other Canaanite deities, if they exist at all, they're just parodies. They're shams of the one true living God who can heal and give new life again. This is his conversion moment right here. And make no mistake about it. This is very, very significant. Things like this don't happen. But here it is. It's happening. And so look at his response. He says, please accept a gift from your servant. I've got all this cash, 10 sets of clothes. The prophet answered, as surely as Yahweh lives, whom I serve, I won't accept a thing. So he's responding, you don't, no, this is not, I didn't do anything. I just told you to go wash in a river, you know? So this isn't my deal. I didn't dispense power and magic on you or something. Yahweh healed you. I'm not going to take a thing. And even though Naaman kept urging him, he refused. And this next part is the part, this all ties together. This next part is the part that really struck me and made me think this is relevant for tonight. Naaman says, okay, if you're not going to take the gift, then let me take something. Please let me, your servant, be given as much dirt as a pair of mules can carry. For your servant is never again going to make burnt offerings or sacrifices to any god other than Yahweh. But here's this one thing. May Yahweh forgive your servant for this one thing. When my master, again, who's that? This is master, when the king. So when my master, the king, enters the temple of Rimmon. So this is the god of Aram. This is the king. He does what he does. It's these official ceremonies. And please, you know, Rimmon, give us rain. Give us victory this year and so on. And so he's like, it's like second in command. So I'm going to go in the ceremony. When my master enters the temple of Rimmon to bow down, and let's say sometimes we're together and he's leaning on my arm, and so I have to bow down too. When I bow down in the temple of Rimmon, may Yahweh please forgive your servant for this. So interesting. So he's saying, what would he like to do? I don't know. Maybe he would like to stay. He had this very powerful encounter with Yahweh's grace that just surprised him, met him, healed him. And he's saying, I can't stay here. I can't camp out in a van down by the river, right? So I can't do that. It's not an option. So I can't stay by the river. I have to go back to my life. And my life is in this very complicated, polytheistic, pagan environment. And my allegiance is to Yahweh alone, but I'm in a minority there and no one else thinks that way or behaves that way. And so I'm going to be in situations that appear like I'm compromising my allegiance to Yahweh, but I'm not. I'm not. Is this okay? Is this okay? And if I can't stay in a van down by the river, then what can I do? Can I take a bit of the dirt with me to remember this place? Do you see that this place, right? So this place isn't like any other spot on the river. This place, and it's not because it's magic, it's because something happened there. God's grace met him in that space, and that was it became a very special space to him. I can't stay here. I got to go live my life. So can I take a wagon load of dirt with me? And so look at Elisha's response to him about this whole going into the temple and so on. What does Elisha say? He's like, yeah, go in peace. Shalom. Shalom. Yeah, it's great. Get out of here. See ya. Go. That's great. That's fine. And that's the story. That's the story. Now, there is a little part B. Elisha's servant saw all of that cash, and he was like, he turned that down. And so he chases Naaman and goes, and that's a whole other interesting episode. But the exchange between Naaman and Elisha is done. So put the story together here. You have this individual. He was not looking for Yahweh. He doesn't care. He's even anti or snobbish. And he has a surprising encounter with God's grace in a place where he was clearly, the river, Jordan, are you kidding? I've got my own rivers. Like, he didn't care. And yet God in his mercy meets this man. And I don't know, maybe you would say he deserves it, maybe you would say he doesn't. That's really not the point. The point is that Yahweh is just the kind of God who surprises people with his grace. It's one of the key themes of this story. And it's this one of many stories like this. It's like Jesus appearing to Paul on the road to Damascus, a man who's actively persecuting Jesus' followers, and Jesus is like, no, you don't. You're not getting away from me. I got your number, and you can't do a darn thing about it. And that's not how all of us experience God's grace. That is how some of us experience God's grace. It becomes this dawning awareness of like, holy cow, if I don't make a choice now and pay attention to what God's saying to me, I don't know. I guess I'm done. You reach this point. And this is where Naaman's at, apparently. We don't know what shifted his mindset to actually make him go there, but he does, and he has this surprising encounter with God's grace. And it makes the space sacred. It's not inherent nature of the space itself. It's not even that God is somehow more present here than some other space. It's that God met him here. And there's a memory attached to that. God is in the business, apparently, of surprising people who was on nobody's top 10 list to become a follower of Yahweh, but it happened. And it's so important to him as he goes back into his very complex environment. He can't just go live by the river. So he says, I'll do the only thing I can think of doing, which is take a whole bunch of dirt with me, and I'll go build an altar at my house. So I can remember this experience and keep alive my allegiance to Yahweh. And that's the story. Do you see where I'm going with this here? So 5 years ago, Josh and Darcy experienced this high degree of what I call just sacred discontent. Where you might be just fine, and you think you're fine, and then all of a sudden, God's doing something in your story, and you can't be at peace anymore. You've got to do what it is you feel like you're supposed to do. And for them, it was to begin a church here at the inner part of the core of Portland, and a church that would be woven into the fabric of just the life and culture of the city. Not to be like the super cool church or whatever, that's stupid. It was just because there aren't a lot of churches that are flourishing, thriving, having an outreach impact, new people coming to Jesus here in the core of the city. There are some, but there's not very many. And so Door of Hope began, started meeting in May 2009 in a yoga studio over off of Alberta. And very quickly that grew, and in June 2009, moved to right here. Some of you have been here since that beginning. Some of you have been here since within that area of 2009. And what's happened here is surprising. Yeah? To say the least. This is remarkable. this space, it was empty. It was owned by Henson. It was empty. It was not being used at the time, and it didn't even look as good as it does now. And it looks pretty good now, but not that great. Actually, what's funny is, so here's what's great about this space and why it's unique to some of us. There are lots of people, and I'll talk more about this in a second, lots of people who have come to faith in Jesus for the first time here at Door of Hope. We live in the city, and so on. And there's something about coming into this space, and it feels like a crappy living room of an East Side apartment. here. You know what I'm talking about? I mean, it's like stuff's broken and so, but it's fine, the moldy carpet or whatever. And it's had a disarming quality on a lot of people. It's like, I would never step foot in a church. I have these coworkers at the grocery store that keep telling me to come to church with them already. And it's like, oh, this is... So someone recently described Door of Hope to Josh as the dive bar of churches in Portland. And then that person was super apologetic, like, oh, I'm sorry. And as Josh shared that story with us, we were just like, that is exactly right. That's exactly right. And this space has been a part of that. And this is remarkable. What's happened here is remarkable. A flourishing community of Jesus where people love to invite their friends who are not Christians, and where every week, and you know, there are probably some here right now, like, you're not a Christian, you wouldn't self-identify, you kind of came with some friends or whatever, and it's great. You're welcome. We love having you here. Come back next week. Or not next week. No, don't come next week. All right, two weeks from now. But you know, it just feels comfortable. We don't pull any punches. We're about Jesus here. And so that was a part of the dream that Josh gave to Josh and Darcy, a community woven in to the fabric and life of Portland, but that is utterly committed to Jesus and to the good news about him, and that we don't apologize for that. In fact, we celebrate it every single week because we think it's the most amazing thing in the world. And the wisdom of just having four pillars of making Jesus and his death, his life, his death, his resurrection, his exaltation, his presence with us in the Spirit to redeem and to heal us, to remind us of his permanent committed love to us despite our flaws and failures, and his death was for us, his life was for us. And just to come around that simple truth of Jesus and to do it in community and to force people into relationships with each other and to make you feel guilty if you're not trying to get connected because you can't follow Jesus alone, and then to simplify the whole thing so that we make everything serve the purpose of people gathering and meeting people and hearing the story of Jesus as much as possible and doing it here in the city. I just described the four pillars to you. And there you go. That's what's happened. And now this is what's happened. And that's remarkable. And most of it has happened in this space over the last 4 years. And, you know, we don't actually count very closely. Maybe we should or maybe we shouldn't. I'm still having this internal debate about this. But we know for sure that in the range of, they have had between 200 and 225 people baptized over the last 4 years. There have been scores of people who grew up around church and they're kind of burned by it or whatever, have some kind of religious upbringing or whatever, and it was weirdo and your parents were screwed up and you're screwed up too, just to remind you. So we're all screwed up, right? And so Door of Hope has become this place where the gospel made sense and what church is and the message about Jesus clicked and you internalized it and owned it for the first time ever. And so it's become that kind of place for lots and lots of people, brand new Christians, people coming back, and then just people being challenged to grow. And it's happening here off of Hawthorne, the bohemian capital of the city, perhaps of the country, not sure about that. And no one saw this coming. Like, this was not planned. I mean, Josh has told me many times he would have been happy and thought that it would just be a house church or something like that. But this has happened. And in a place that nobody saw it coming, this is not a place where churches tend to thrive and grow and see lots of new conversions. That hasn't really happened in the recent history of the city in this part of town. This is remarkable, you guys. Do you realize this? What's happened here is surprising. It's like God meeting a pagan captain of the Aramean army down in a van by the river. Right? Like, that is remarkable. No one saw it coming. I've had friends come visit Door of Hope, and one of the remarks they often say is, you know, just meet people and they're around, and they're just like, man, it's just crazy, and I love it, but it's just crazy to see all kinds of people going to church that I would never peg as going to church if I saw them walking down Hawthorne, you know? And it's just like, yeah, that's exactly right. That's what this is about. And so that's happened. Some of you were not on anybody you know's list of becoming a Christian in the last year, yep, but here it's happened. It happened to you. It happened to a lot of you. So for some of you, you were not looking for Jesus. in fact, you were anti, or you were snobbish, or you're like, okay, Jesus, all right, but the church, whatever. And something about what's happening here is just kind of blown your categories. And it has mine too. And that's why the fact that we're not tied to a certain denomination, it has its challenges, not being tied to a larger network or denomination. But we're not, this isn't about like being about one thing or some doctrinal tradition or whatever. It's just make Jesus the center. And people will come to know that Jesus and have their lives transformed and healed. And that's what happens. And that's what's happened here. It's remarkable. And so each of us has our own story about what's happened to us here. Each of us has our own kind of Naaman story about the surprising way that you've been forced to grow, about stuff that's happened in your life, the message that you heard, it's someone that you met, it's a conversation that you've had generated around our gathering here that's led to significant change in your life. Many of us, just think of your story. We all have a version of Naaman's story here. And for some of us, this space has a different kind of value and symbolic value. And I've said this many times. For me, part of it is that I grew up two blocks from here and that I graffitied that side of the building when I was 16. And so that itself, and then I'm here, but I'm a pastor. And it's weird. That's weird to me. You know, I didn't plan on this. I never planned on any of this. And many of you never plan on becoming Christians. But here we are. Surprise, surprise. That's what God's grace does. It surprises us. And so this space is special. It's special to a lot of us. Significant things have happened here for many of us. How do you remember and memorialize the sacred beauty of a space like this, where memories like this have been made? And so what did Naaman do? He took a load of dirt. A load of dirt with him. And so here's my idea. this afternoon, I went out and dug a big pile of dirt from behind the building. And I put it in this wheelbarrow that I grew up using when I was a kiddo on 22nd, just a few blocks from here. And so here it is. Here's the dirt. I'm going to park it differently than I did last time. About 250 almost tripped to their death last at the last service because of this. So here's what we're going to do. Here's a whole bunch of dirt from this site, right out behind the back of the building. And during communion, as we close in a time of communion and worship, I would just encourage you to think about your story, about your own story of conversion that's happened here, about you coming back to understand and grasp and internalize and own the faith that you let go for a really long time. Think about the moments where relationships in your life have been healed because you decided to follow Jesus and actually begin following his teachings and discovering the healing that comes through living and being empowered by his presence. Think through the moments of growth, whatever that is. And during the time of worship, I just encourage you to come grab a handful of dirt and put it in this big bucket right here. And what we're going to do is find as close as we can trees to the Door of Hope trees. And there's been a few candidates proposed. Olive tree, ficus tree, monkey glove tree, somebody said. I have no idea. So anyway, we're going to find a tree, and we're gonna plant them. We're going to plant trees over at Northeast. We're going to take the dirt with us, plant some trees with them, and we'll do it outside, or maybe we'll even make them like potted indoor trees to remember and to take with us the sacred memories of what's happened here for us. What do you guys think? Yeah. So I'm going to close this in prayer, and we're going to enter into our time of taking the bread in the cup, and I just think really encourage you, like, this is worthy of celebrating, you guys. Something remarkable's happened here, and it's you. And it's Jesus meeting you guys here and me. And so let's go for it, you know? Let's celebrate it, let's remember it, let's thank Jesus for it. As you go to the different stations around and take the bread and the cup, make it a reflection moment to think about where you've come in your story. And also to just pray that there would be 1,000, 10,000 more Naaman stories to be told as we go from here to another part of the city. Let me close in a word of prayer.